Chapter 5. Overcoat over his arm, Bruno Bluthgeld walked up Oxford Street, through the campus of the University of California, bent over and not looking about him. He knew the route well, and he did not care to see the students, the young people. He was not interested in the passing cars or in the buildings, so many of them knew. He did not see the city of Berkeley because he was not interested in it. He was thinking, and it seemed to him very clearly now, that he understood what it was that was making him sick. He did not doubt that he was sick. He felt deeply sick. It was only a question of locating the source of contamination. It was, he thought, coming to him from the outside, this illness, the terrible infection that had sent him at last to Dr. Stockstill. Have the psychiatrist, on the basis of today's first visit, any valid theory? Bruno Bluthgeld doubted it. And then, as he walked, he noticed that all the cross streets to the left leaned, as if the city was sinking on that side, as if gradually it was keeling over. Bluthgeld felt amused, because he recognized the distortion. It was his astigmatism, which became acute when he was under stress. Yes, he felt as if he were walking along a tilted sidewalk, raised on one side so that everything had a tendency to slide. He felt himself sliding very gradually, and he had trouble placing one foot before the other. He had a tendency to veer, to totter to the left, too, along with the other things. Sense data so vital, he thought, not merely what you perceive, but how. He chuckled as he walked. Easy to lose your balance when you have an acute astigmatic condition, he said to himself. How pervasively the sense of balance enters into our awareness of the universe around us. Hearing is derived from the sense of balance. It's an unrecognized basic sense underlying the others. Perhaps I have picked up a mild labyrinthitis, a virus infection of the middle ear. Should have it looked into. And yes, now it, the distortion in his sense of balance, had begun affecting his hearing, as he had anticipated. It was fascinating how the eye and the ear joined to produce a gestalt. First his eyesight, then his balance. Now he heard things askew. He heard, as he walked, a dull, deep echo which rose from his own footsteps, from his shoes striking the pavement. Not the sharp, brisk noise that a woman's shoe might make, but a shadowy, low sound, a rumble, almost as if it rose from a pit or cave. It was not a pleasant sound. It hurt his head, sending up reverberations that were acutely painful. He slowed, altered his pace, watched his shoes strike the pavement so as to anticipate the sound. "I know what this is due to," he said to himself. He had experienced it in the past. This echoing of normal noises in the labyrinths of his ear passages. Like the distortion in vision, it had a simple physiological basis, although for years it had puzzled and frightened him. It was due, simply, to tense posture, skeletal tension, specifically at the base of the neck. In fact, by turning his head from side to side, he could test his theory out. He heard the neck vertebrae give a little crack, a short, sharp sound that set up immediately the most immensely painful reverberations in his ear channels. I must be dreadfully worried today, Bruno Bluthgeld said to himself, for now an even graver alteration in his sense perceptions was setting in, and one unfamiliar to him. A dull, smoky cast was beginning to settle over all the environment around him, making the buildings and cars seem like inert, gloomy mounds, without color or motion. And where were the people? He seemed to be plodding along totally by himself in his listing, difficult journey up Oxford Street to where he had parked his Cadillac. Had they, odd thought, all gone indoors? As if, he thought, to get out of the rain? This rain of fine sooty particles that seemed to fill the air, to impede his breathing, his sight, his progress. He stopped, and, standing there at the intersection, seeing down the side street where it descended into a kind of darkness, and then off to the right where it rose and snapped off, as if twisted and broken, he saw, to his amazement, and this he could not explain immediately in terms of some specific physiological impairment of function, that cracks had opened up. The buildings to his left had split, jagged breaks in them, as if the hardest of substances, the cement itself which underlay the city, making up the streets and buildings, the very foundations around him, were coming apart. Good Christ, he thought. What is it? He peered into the sooty fog. Now the sky was gone, obscured entirely by the rain of dark. And then he saw, picking about in the gloom, among the split sections of concrete, in the debris, little shriveled shapes, people, the pedestrians who had been there before and then vanished. They were back now, but all of them dwarfed and gaping at him sightlessly, not speaking but simply poking about in an aimless manner. "What is it?" he asked himself again, this time speaking aloud. He heard his voice dully rebounding. "It's all broken. The town is broken up into pieces. What has hit it? What has happened to it?" He began to walk from the pavement, finding his way among the strewn severed parts of Berkeley. "It isn't me," he realized. "Some great, terrible catastrophe has happened." The noise now boomed in his ears, and the soot stirred, moved by the noise. A car horn sounded, stuck on, but very far off and faint. Standing in the front of Modern TV, watching the television coverage of Walter and Mrs. Dangerfield's flight, Stuart McConchie saw to his surprise the screen go blank.
"Lost their picture,"
Lighthizer said disgustedly. The group of people stirred with indignation. Lighthizer chewed on his toothpick.
"It'll come back on," Stuart said, bending to switch to another channel. It was, after all, being covered by all networks. All channels were blank, and there was no sound either. He switched it once more, still nothing. Up from the basement came one of the repairmen, running toward the front of the store, yelling,
"Red alert!"
"What's that?"
Lighthizer said wonderingly, and his face became old and unhealthy-looking. Seeing it, Stuart McConchie knew, without the words or the thoughts ever occurring in his mind. He did not have to think. He knew, and he ran out of the store onto the street. He ran onto the empty sidewalk and stood, and the group of people at the TV set, seeing him and the repairman running, began to run too, in different directions, some of them across the street out into traffic, some of them in circles, some of them away in a straight line, as if each of them saw something different, as if it was not the same thing happening to any two of them. Stuart and Lighthizer ran up the sidewalk to where the gray-green metal sidewalk doors were, which opened onto the underground storage basement that once, a long time ago, a drugstore had used for its stock, but which now was empty. Stuart tore at the metal doors, and so did Lighthizer, and both of them yelled that it wouldn't open. There was no way to open it except from below. At the entrance of the men's clothing store, a clerk appeared, saw them. Lighthizer shouted at him, yelled for him to run downstairs and open up the sidewalk.
"Open the sidewalk!"
Lighthizer yelled, and so did Stuart, and now so did several people, all standing or squatting at the sidewalk doors, waiting for the sidewalk to open. So the clerk turned and ran back into the clothing store. A moment later, a clanking noise sounded under Stuart's feet.
"Get back,"
a heavy-set elderly man said.
"Get off the doors."
The people saw down into cold gloom, a cave under the sidewalk, an empty cavity. They all jumped down into it, falling to the bottom. They lay pressed against damp concrete, rolling themselves up into balls or flattening themselves out. They squirmed and pressed down into crumbly soil with the dead sow bugs and the smell of decay.
"Close it from above,"
a man was saying. There did not seem to be any women, or if there were, they were silent. His head pressed into a corner of the concrete, Stuart listened but heard only men, heard them as they grabbed at the doors above, trying to shut them. More people came down now, falling and tumbling and yelling as if dumped from above.
"How long, O Lord?"
a man was saying. Stuart said,
"Now."
He knew it was now. He knew that the bombs were going off. He felt them. It seemed to occur inside him. Blam, 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 blam went the bombs. Or perhaps it was things sent up by the army to help, to stop the bombs. Perhaps it was defense. "Let me down," Stuart thought, "low as I can be. Let me into the ground." He pressed down, rolled his body to make a depression. People lay now on top of him, choking coats and sleeves, and he was glad. He did not mind. He did not want emptiness around him. He wanted solidness on every side. He did not need to breathe. His eyes were shut, they and the other openings of his body, his mouth and ears and nose, all had shut. He had walled himself in, waiting. Blam, blam, blam. The ground jumped.
"We'll get by," Stuart said. "Down here. Safe in the earth. Safe. Inside, where it's safe. It'll pass by overhead, the wind." The wind, above on the surface, passed by at huge speed. He knew it moved up there, the air itself, driven along altogether as a body.
In the nose cone of Dutchman 4, Walt Dangerfield, while still experiencing the pressure of many gravities on his body, heard in his earphones the voices from below, from the control bunker.
"Third stage successful, Walt. You're in orbit. We'll fire off the final stage at 1545 instead of 1544, they tell me.
Orbital velocity, Dangerfield said to himself, straining to see his wife. She had lost consciousness. He looked away from her at once, concentrating on his oxygen supply, knowing she was all right, but not wanting to witness her suffering. Okay, he thought, we're okay. In orbit, waiting for the final thrust. It wasn't so bad. The voice in his earphone said,
A perfect sequence so far, Walt. The president is standing by. You have 8 minutes, 6 seconds before the initial corrections for the fourth stage firing. If in correcting minor...
Static erased the voice. He no longer heard it. If in correcting minor but vital errors in attitude, Walter Dangerfield said to himself, there is a lack of complete success, we will be brought back down, as they did before in the robot runs. And later on we will try it again. There is no danger. Re-entry is an old story. He waited. The voice in his earphones came on again.
Walter, we are under attack down here.
What? He said. What'd you say?
God save us,
the voice said. It was a man already dead. The voice had no feeling. It was empty, and then it was silent. Gone.
From whom?
Walt Dangerfield said into his microphone. He thought of pickets and rioters. He thought of bricks, angry mobs. Attacked by nuts or something, is that it? He struggled up, disconnected himself from the straps, saw through the port the world below, clouds and the ocean, the globe itself. Here and there on it, matches were lit. He saw the puffs, the flares. Fright overcame him as he sailed silently through space, looking down at the pinches of burning scattered about. He knew what they were. It's death, he thought. Death lighting up spots, burning up the world's life second by second. He continued to watch. There was, Dr. Stockstill knew, a community shelter under one of the big banks, but he could not remember which one. Taking his secretary by the hand, he ran from the building and across Center Street, searching for the black-and-white sign that he had noticed 1,000 times, that had become part of the perpetual background of his daily business existence on the public street. The sign had merged into the unchanging, and now he needed it. He wanted it to step forward so that he could notice it as he had at the beginning, as a real sign, meaning something vital, something by which to preserve his life. It was his secretary, tugging at his arm, who pointed the way to him. She yelled in his ear over and over again, and he saw. He turned in that direction, and together they crossed the street, running out into the dead, stalled traffic and among the pedestrians, and then they were struggling and fighting to get into the shelter, which was the basement of the building. As he burrowed down, lower and lower, into the basement shelter, and the mass of people pressed together in it, he thought about the patient whom he had just seen. He thought about Mr. Tree, and in his mind a voice said with clarity, You did this. See what you did? You've killed us all. His secretary had become separated from him, and he was alone with people he did not know, breathing into their faces and being breathed on. And all the time he heard a wailing, the noise of women, and probably their small children, shoppers who had come in here from the department stores, midday mothers. Are the doors shut? He wondered. Has it begun? It has. The moment has. He closed his eyes and began to pray out loud, noisily, trying to hear the sound, but the sound was lost.
Stop that racket!
Someone, a woman, said in his ear, so close that his ear hurt. He opened his eyes. The woman, middle-aged, glared at him, as if this was all that mattered, as if nothing was happening except his noisy praying. Her attention was directed on stopping him, and in surprise he stopped. Is that what you care about? He wondered. Awed by her, by the narrowness of her attention, by its mad constrictedness.
Sure, he said to her. You damn fool,
he said, but she did not hear him.
Was I bothering you?
He went on, unheeded. She was now glaring at someone else who had bumped or shoved her.
Sorry, he said. Sorry, you stupid old crow, you...
He cursed at the woman, cursing instead of praying, and feeling more relief by that. He got more out of that. And then, in the middle of his cursing, he had a weird, vivid notion. The war had begun, and they were being bombed and would probably die. But it was Washington that was dropping the bombs on them, not the Chinese or the Russians. Something had gone wrong with an automatic defense system out in space, and it was acting out its cycle this way, and no one could halt it either. It was war and death, yes, but it was error. It lacked intent. He did not feel any hostility from the forces overhead. They were not vengeful or motivated. They were empty, hollow, completely cold. It was as if his car had run over him. It was real, but meaningless. It was not policy. It was breakdown and failure. Chance. So, at this moment, he felt himself devoid of retaliatory hatred for the enemy because he could not imagine, did not actually believe in, or even understand the concept. It was as if the previous patient, Mr. Tree, or Dr. Bluthgeld, or whoever he had been, had taken in, absorbed all that, left none of it for anyone else. Bluthgeld had made Stockstill over into a different person, one who could not think that way even now. Bluthgeld, by being insane, had made the concept of the enemy unbelievable.
"We'll fight back! We'll fight back! We'll fight back!"
a man near Dr. Stockstill was chanting. Stockstill looked at him in astonishment, wondering who he would fight back against. Things were falling on them. Did the man intend to fall back upward into the sky in some kind of revenge? Would he reverse the natural forces at work, as if rolling a film sequence backward? It was a peculiar, nonsensical idea. It was as if the man had been gripped by his unconscious. He was no longer living a rational, ego-directed existence. He had surrendered to some archetype. "The impersonal," Dr. Stockstill thought, "has attacked us. That is what it is, attacked us from inside and out. The end of the cooperation, where we applied ourselves together. Now it's atoms only, discrete, without any windows, colliding but not making any sound, just a general hum." He put his fingers in his ears, trying not to hear the noises from around him. The noises appeared, absurdly, to be below him, rising instead of descending. He wanted to laugh. Jim Ferguson, when the attack began, had just gone downstairs into the repair department of Modern TV. Facing Hoppy Harrington, he saw the expression on the Facomalus's face when the red alert was announced over the FM radio, and the Conalrad system went at once into effect. He saw on the lean, bony face a grin like that of greed, as if in hearing and understanding, Hoppy was filled with joy, the joy of life itself. He had become lit up for an instant, had thrown off everything that inhibited him or held him to the surface of the earth, every force that made him slow. His eyes burst into light, and his lips twitched. He seemed to be sticking out his tongue, as if mocking Ferguson. To him, Ferguson said, "You dirty little freak!" The folkie yelled, "It's the end!" The look on his face was already gone. Perhaps he had not even heard what Ferguson had said. He seemed to be in a state of self-absorption. He shivered, and the artificial manual extensors emanating from his cart danced and flicked like whips. "Now listen," Ferguson said. "We're below street level." He caught hold of the repairman, Bob Rubenstein. "You moronic jackass, stay where you are. I'll go upstairs and get those people down here. You clear as much space as you can. Make space for them." He let go of the repairman and ran to the stairs. As he started up the steps, two at a time, clutching the handrail and using it as a fulcrum, something happened to his legs. The bottom part of him fell off, and he pitched backward, rolled back and down, and onto him rained tons of white plaster. His head hit the concrete floor, and he knew that the building had been hit, taken away, and the people were gone. He was hurt, too, cut into two pieces, and only Hoppy and Bob Rubenstein would survive, and maybe not even they. He tried to speak, but could not. Still at the repair bench, Hoppy felt the concussion, and saw the doorway fill up with pieces of the ceiling, and the wood of the steps turned into flying fragments, and among the fragments of wood something soft, bits of flesh. If the pieces were Ferguson, he was dead. The building shook and boomed, as if doors were shutting. "We're shut in," Hoppy realized. The overhead light popped, and now he saw nothing. Blackness. Bob Rubenstein was screeching. The folkie wheeled his cart backward into the black cavity of the basement, going by the touch of his extensors. He felt his way among the stock inventory, the big television sets and their cardboard cartons. He got as deep as possible, slowly and carefully burrowed in all the way to the back, as far from the entrance as he could. Nothing fell on him. Ferguson had been right. This was safe here below the street level. Upstairs they were all rags of flesh, mixed with the white, dry powder that had been the building, but here it was different. "Just not time," he thought. "They told us, and then it began. It's still going on. He could feel the wind moving over the surface upstairs. It moved unimpeded, because everything which had stood was now down. We must not go up even later, because of radiation, he realized. That was the mistake those Japs made. They came right up and smiled. How long will I live down here, he wondered. A month? No water unless a pipe breaks. No air after a while, unless molecules filtering through the debris. Still better than trying to come out. I will not come out, he reiterated. I know better. I'm not dumb like the others. Now he heard nothing. No concussion, no rain of falling pieces in the darkness around him. Small objects jarred loose from stacks and from shelves. Just silence. He did not hear Bob Rubenstein. Matches. From his pocket he got matches, lit one. He saw the TV cartons had toppled to enclose him. He was alone in a space of his own. Oh, boy, he said to himself with exultation. Am I lucky? This space was just made for me. I'll stay and stay. I can go days and then be alive. I know I was intended to be alive. Ferguson was intended to die right off the bat. It's God's will. God knows what to do. He watches out. There is no chance about this. All this, a great cleansing of the world. Room must be made. New space for people. For instance, myself. He put out the match, and the darkness returned. He did not mind it. Waiting in the middle of his cart, he thought, "This is my chance. It was made for me deliberately. It'll be different when I emerge. Destiny at work from the start, back before I was born. Now I understand it all, my being so different from the others. I see the reason." How much time has passed? He wondered presently. He had begun to become impatient. An hour? I can't stand to wait, he realized. I mean, I have to wait, but I wish it would hurry up. He listened for the possible sound of people overhead, rescue teams from the army beginning to dig people out, but not yet, nothing so far. I hope it isn't too long, he said to himself. There's lots to do. I have work ahead of me. When I get out of here, I have to get started and organize, because that's what will be needed, organization and direction. Everyone will be milling around. Maybe I can plan now. In the darkness, he planned. All manner of inspirations came to him. He was not wasting his time, not being idle just because he had to be stationary. His head wildly rang with original notions. He could hardly wait, thinking about them and how they would work when tried out. Most of them had to do with ways of survival. No one would be dependent on big society. It would all be small towns and individuality, like Ayn Rand talked about in her books. It would be the end of conformity in the mass mind and junk. No more factory-produced junk like the cartons of color 3D television sets which had fallen on all sides of him. His heart pounded with excitement and impatience. He could hardly stand waiting. It was like a million years already, and still they hadn't found him yet, even though they were busy looking. He knew that. He could feel them at work, getting nearer.
"Hurry!"
he exclaimed aloud, lashing his manual extensors. The tips scratched against the TV cartons, making a dull sound. In his impatience, he began to beat on the cartons. The drumming filled the darkness, as if there were many living things imprisoned, an entire nest of people, not just Hoppy Harrington alone. In her hillside home in West Marin County, Bonnie Keller realized that the classical music on the stereo set in the living room had gone off. She emerged from the bedroom, wiping the watercolor paint from her hands and wondering if the same tube as before had, as George put it, cut out. And then, through the window, she saw against the sky to the south a stout trunk of smoke, as dense and brown as a living stump. She gaped at it, and then the window burst. It pulverized, and she crashed back and slid across the floor along with the powdery fragments of it. Every object in the house tumbled, fell and shattered, and then skidded with her, as if the house had tilted on end. The San Andreas Fault, she knew. Terrible earthquake, like back 80 years ago. All we've built, all ruined. Spinning, she banged into the far wall of the house. Only now it was level and the floor had raised up. She saw lamps and tables and chairs raining down and smashing, and it was amazing to her how flimsy everything was. She could not understand how things she had owned for years could break so easily. Only the wall itself, now beneath her, remained as something hard. My house, she thought. Gone. Everything that's mine, that means something to me. Oh, it isn't fair. Her head ached as she lay panting. She smoothed herself, saw her hands white and covered with fine powder and trembling. Blood streaked her wrist from some cut she could not make out.
Oh, my head, she thought. She rubbed her forehead, and bits of material fell from her hair. Now, she could not understand it. The floor was flat again. The wall was upright, as it had always been. Back to normal. But the objects, they were all broken. That remained. The garbage house, she thought. It'll take weeks, months. We'll never build back. It's the end of our life, our happiness. Standing, she walked about. She kicked the pieces of a chair aside. She kicked through the trash toward the door. The air swirled with particles, and she inhaled them. She choked on them, hating them. Glass everywhere, all her lovely plate glass windows gone. Empty square holes with a few shards, which still broke loose and dropped even as she watched. She found a door. It had been bent open. Shoving it, putting her weight against it, she made it move aside so that she could go unsteadily out of the house to stand a few yards away, surveying what had happened. Her headache had become worse. Am I blinded? She wondered. It was hard to keep her eyes open. Did I see a light? She had a memory of one click of light, like a camera shutter opening so suddenly, so swiftly, that her optic nerves had not responded. She had not really seen it. And yet her eyes were hurt. She felt the injury there. Her body, all of her, seemed damaged, and no wonder. But the ground, she did not see any fissure. And the house stood, only the windows and the household goods had been destroyed. The structure, the empty container, remained, with nothing left in it. Walking slowly along, she thought, I better go get help. I need medical help. And then, as she stumbled and half fell, she looked around her, up into the air, and saw once again the column of brown smoke from the south. Did San Francisco catch fire already? She asked herself. It's burning, she decided. It's a calamity. The city got it, not just West Marin here. Not just a few rural people up here, but all the city people. There must be thousands dead. They'll have to declare a national emergency and get the Red Cross and Army. We'll remember this to the day we die. Walking, she began to cry, holding her hands to her face, not seeing where she was going, not caring. She did not cry for herself or her ruined house now. She cried for the city to the south. She cried for all the people and things in it and what had happened to them. I'll never see it again, she knew. There is no more San Francisco. It is over. The end had come about today. Crying, she wandered on in the general direction of town. Already she could hear people's voices rising up from the flatland below. Going by the sound, she moved that way. A car drew up beside her. The door opened. A man reached out for her. She did not even know if he lived around here or if he was passing through. Anyhow, she hugged him. All right, the man said, squeezing her around the waist. Sobbing, she struggled closer to him, pressing herself against the car seat and drawing him over her. Later, she once more found herself walking, this time down a narrow road with oak trees, the gnarled old live oaks which she loved so much on both sides of her. The sky overhead was bleak and gray, swept by heavy clouds which drifted in monotonous procession toward the north. This must be Bear Valley Ranch Road, she said to herself. Her feet hurt, and when she stopped, she discovered that she was barefoot. Somewhere along the way, she had lost her shoes. She still wore the paint-splattered jeans which she had had on when the quake had happened, when the radio had gone off. Or had it really been a quake after all? The man in the car, frightened and babbling like a baby, had said something else, but it had been too garbled, too full of panic for her to understand. I want to go home, she said to herself. I want to be back in my own home, and I want my shoes. I'll bet that man took them. I'll bet they're back in his car, and I'll never see them again. She plodded on, wincing at the pain, wishing she could find somebody, wondering about the sky overhead, and becoming more lonely with each passing moment.